Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asian Focus newsletter. Our topic is recent violence in Central Asia's only two autonomous regions, Gorno-Badakhshan in eastern Tajikistan and Karakalpakstan in western Uzbekistan. In both regions, government security forces initiated harsh crackdowns on the local populations after protests broke out. Authorities in the two countries say this was necessary to restore order, but there are numerous allegations of rights violations, and clearly the government narratives do not tell the whole story. To discuss this topic, today I'm joined by Bakhtiar Safaro, who is the founder of Central Asian Consulting in the USA, but is originally from the Gorno-Badakhshan region of Tajikistan. Our next guest we're going to call Murat Kadirov. He's originally from Karakalpakstan, and we're calling him Murat on this program due to concerns for the safety of people close to him who are still in Karakalpakstan. And our old Mejlis friend, Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Thank you all for joining me today. And I want to start by looking at the situation in these two regions first, prior to the violence and over the course of the year. So Bakhtiar, if I could start with you, could you please describe the social and economic situation in Gorno-Badakhshan compared to the rest of Tajikistan?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce and distinguished guests. It's a pleasure to come back to the program again. Mejlis Podcast is my favorite program that I listen every Saturday, and it's just amazing to be here with all of you. Again, my name is Bakhtiar Safarov, and I'm a founder of Central Asia Consulting. So, yeah, in regard to economic and social situation in Gorno-Badakhshan, autonomous oblast, is very drastic. So we can say that the region has been in blockade after the 1992. So if you just compare it to the rest of the country, it's in a very economically it's a completely different economy, by the way, because what happened is 1992, the people from that area didn't actually or weren't allowed for different reason to work for the government. So they kind of build their own life around the different sources. So a lot of people start traveling to different countries, and a lot of population like me, we join the international community. So we start with international community. We kind of and the whole region, just very simple example, like in Vanj district, we have literally a village that lives in Russia. That's like they have their own community there, and everybody, whoever graduates, they go to Russia. So it's kind of even economically, it's independent. And socially, of course, it all depends on the economy, and socially, it's also kind of connected to overseas. Like, a lot of people right now, because they actually outside of the Gabao, and they socially kind of also, the region is also connected to the rest of it. I would say it's more connected to outside of the Tajikistan rather than to inside of Tajikistan, if you know what I mean. So it just have the whole autonomy by all means at this point. So but again, it's difficult for the autonomy to survive. That's why the whole remittances and all support that's coming from outside is definitely not enough. So that's why economically and socially, we can say the region is not doing that well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Murat, I got the same question for you. Could you describe the social and economic situation in Karakalpakstan? And if anything that Bakhtiar just said sounds familiar to you, could you please, mention that the situation is similar?
I'm hearing him and... Yes, I would say it's similar, except the Karakalpakstan is a sovereign republic, and as some human rights or the journalists shy to say so, mostly referencing it as a autonomous province of the Uzbekistan, it is not. It is sovereign republic Karakalpakstan, and social issues, basically, it's not because as region it cannot sustain itself. It's, we have to remember, it's 40% of the Uzbekistan, and having 2 million, less than 2 million people, they can sustain themselves very easily, I would say. And basically, it's the result of, I think, on the top of the, in whole, Uzbekistan is not in good shape in terms of the social situation. That the actually, logically, if you common sense actually says, Karel Pakistan should be very prospering among all the other regions or the provinces of the Uzbekistan, but the continuous and consistent hidden agenda of Uzbekistan to erase, suppress the Karakalpak identity. When I say Karakalpak identity, I'm talking about only ethnic Karakalpaks. By the way, Kazakh people and Uzbek people in Karakalpakstan are different. They, for the generations grown up there, and they stand all together in the against that suppression.
Okay, thank you. I want to follow up just for a second, though, to make clear that Gornobadakhshan, of course, is up way up in the mountains, so it's a little bit more remote, and yet Karakalpakstan is out in the western area in the desert of Uzbekistan. Now, you said Karakalpakstan could be prosperous. What is out in Karakalpakstan that could make it prosperous that is not being used?
It's being used, but it's being used by the Uzbek government and returning nothing to the Karakalpak people. The major part of the Uzbek gas sold to Russia is Karakalpak gas. Besides that, all there is a lot of mineral elements and gold in there. And it's, of course, this all these facts are hidden because the any information is tightly controlled by the Uzbek authoritarian government.
Okay, thank you for explaining that a little bit further. Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit and ask you, what's your understanding of the situation for activists and civic movements in these two regions? They're clearly distinct areas of their countries. And certainly they must have some grassroots kind of movements or certainly are some very influential local figures. How is that, if you can give us an idea how that plays out in both these areas?
Well, glad to be on the spot, Bruce, and good to be with Bakhtiyor and Murat. You know, I'd say that, well, first of all, this is incredibly timely, and it's important to look beyond, as you're doing properly, looking at the context beyond the violence that I'm sure we're going to get to in a moment. But when we look at the Pamiri community, as Bakhtiyor said, it's an area that during the Soviet period had incredibly high rates of literacy. Moscow was very proactive in making Khorog, in a way, an attractive place to go to, and maybe it's by virtue of its border proximity to, you know, to the borders, the outer borders of the Soviet Union. It's not exactly clear to me why that is, but it's always been historically very significant that the Pamirs were known as, on the one hand, very isolated, but on the other hand, huge investments in education, which in the post-Soviet period meant that, as Bakhtiyor rightly said, you had a very rich civil society, educational institutions supported by the Aga Khan Foundation. In a way, you know, somewhat of an oasis. And, you know, I'm talking now a little bit more pre-2014 here, before Tajikistan goes down into a human rights crisis, which it's, you know, almost a decade now. It's been really abysmal. I think you can look at the Pamiri civil society activist community you were asking about, and you can see an incredibly, like I said, rich intelligentsia. You had lawyers, like one of the lawyers that's now detained, Manuchehr Holik Nazarov. He headed up an organization called the Association of Pamiri Lawyers, and they did very important work. They were really at the forefront of civil society, and in some ways they led and led by example and helped Tajik activists in other parts of Tajikistan to do work. So that's one picture, I would say, of a very proactive and, as Bakhtiyor was saying, insular, tight-knit, strongly, strong community. Moving to Karakalpakstan, now that's another story, and it's quite fascinating because when I was based in Bishkek about 10 years ago, I started getting to know the exiled community of Karakalpak activists. And these were people that were outside of Uzbekistan for a good reason. The reason being that President Karimov, who we know was always a hardliner, who never wanted to discuss issues of ethnic minorities, whether be they Tajiks, be they Karakalpaks, was intent on suppressing any discussion of autonomy, of sovereignty, as Murat has said. And so the activists that we know of mostly resided in Kazakhstan, in Moscow. I mean, the political activists. In terms of the non-political civil society, well, when you go to Nukus, as I did in the Mirziyoyev period, you'd see that, you know, it was a very, the region seemed still pretty locked down tightly. When I was there in 2019, I did actually witness a modest low-level protest by activists that were carrying Karakalpak flags. This was on the Independence Day of the Republic of Karakalpakstan, December 16th. And they were very quickly, within 5 minutes, violently arrested, taken off the streets. And so it's harder to speak, at least from my perspective, Murat might be able to help me out here, but it's harder to gauge the extent to which the activist community was vibrant or if it was really mostly exiled.
You're right. I think that's the most like a bright indicator of what is going on. That's actually the national holiday of Day of Constitution. What could be more like a government thing and people celebrating that get arrested? That is actually indicator how bad is the suppression of the Karakalpakstan identity. I'm not saying Karakalpak identity. So it is right now, I think Karakalpak people more worried about their status and their future, and they tolerate a lot of issues. If we look back at the history, Karakalpak people a little different than Uzbek people who for centuries were settled and were under the Hanship, and they kind of had that style of life under a bigger authority and thing. But Karakalpak people are free spirits. They were a nomad people, and all their relationship with the other groups were based on the negotiation, and they I would say more democratic spirits are here. That's why actually unexpected raise of people when Uzbek government tried ironically Article 70 of the Constitution, where existing article states actually sovereignty of Republic Karakalpakstan is protected by Republic Uzbekistan, and by using that article, they actually trying to encroach, impinge the sovereignty of the Republic Karakalpakstan.
You know, and I'm going to go to Bakhtiar in a minute too, in just a second, but I want to ask you, Murad, real quickly, understanding that this is a sovereign republic, at least according constitutionally, Karakalpakstan is a sovereign republic. What's the feeling of all the people inside the Karakalpakstan sovereign republic then? You mentioned that there was other groups, there's a lot of Uzbeks there, there's Kazakhs, and there's other people. Do all those other groups identify with being part of the Karakalpakstan Republic, or is it more that the ethnic Karakalpaks see this or feel this more strongly?
Yes, they do. Actually, I think they do, because when in school we were in Karakalpak school, and in Karakalpak school we had the Uzbek pupil who went to the Karakalpak classes, despite having Uzbek classes available to them in the same school. I grew up and we never knew the difference between these pupil. And recently, suddenly, it started doing like a Karakalpak, Uzbek, Kazakh. Karakalpaks are a minority. And I think even they stand with, as all Karakalpak people for their sovereignty.
Okay, and Bakhtiar, it's the situation in Gunabakhshan is a little bit different. The people are distinct, certainly, but I've never seen or heard anyway that there was any movement to be independent from Tajikistan, or that people wanted anything more than the autonomous status that the region had. Is that true, or do you have a different understanding?
Yeah, I actually never heard of anybody saying that they want to be independent. And yes, or Gorno-Badakhshan autonomy is very specific, and the region is specific. We have even in this area, we have several languages that being spoken. I mean, dialects. We have, you know, Tajik speak, people speak Tajik. We speak, have people speak Shugnan. We have Vakhan language. We have Kyrgyz language. And all this region is diverse. We also have people who, you know, have Shia Muslims. We have Sunni Muslims. And we actually have a small people who are, you know, Christianity now. And they do with the missions in Khorog and they live there. So these are the recent trends that we see. So it's very multicultural. And like I said, in these 30 years, people, because we actually were forced to leave Tajikistan during the civil war because of our independent views. So we kind of, you know, were segregated in this area for the last 30 years. And people understood. It's like, yeah, look, they have their own way and the people build their own lives. So now they come after so many years, people build their own life. They don't actually talk about politics. Not so much. They build their own life. And now they're going to come every time and literally want to ban people. But the people already kind of get used to it. It's been 30 years. We have a new generation of people who grew up freely. I mean, you can't ban those people. It's not going to work. That's what this government is like. You let your kid go and you're not asking about him, what he's doing, how he's surviving. And then after 30 years, hey, I want you to come back. It doesn't work that way. You know, you have to. They didn't do anything to bring the government to people of Badakhshan close to the center. They didn't do anything. They didn't try. They were busy with their own problems to make themselves rich. The corruptions, you know, the change in constitutions, not having a free and fair elections, and that the people build their own lives. So this is a little different than what's happening in Karakalpakstan, I would say.
Oh, you know, I'm just going to ask before we have the halftime break here, Murad, if you could just comment a little bit on that too. What kind of government attention has Karakalpakstan seen in the last 30 years since independence? I mean, is there a lot of government influence out there? Very little. How is it working out there?
If you're talking about the Karakalpak government, it's basically people don't have real representation it's called their parliament. Our parliament is the Johara Kinges, and they don't have real representation because of all the election and elected people are tightly controlled by the Uzbekistan. They have to be very conformists. Whatever they do, the you can see that from the blame of the officials saying that initiative to strip off the sovereignty comes from the deputies of the Ali Majlis. Actually, the human rights defender, Devlet Murat Tajimuratov, actually discovered that they've been forced to enter that suggestion. So that is one of the main problems of the Karakalpak people, that they don't have sovereignty in terms of the representation of their people and for self-determination. We can see the sentiments on the analysis and journalists saying that, it's so small, small country, how much sovereignty they have and think. We need to call the things by their names. It is sovereign republic, and we have to make the excuse back in the days when Soviet Union fell. If you remember, in 1990s, 91, Republic Karakalpakstan they declared their sovereignty, and they stayed about 3 years really sovereign, I would say. And in 1993, Karimov started taking over Karakalpakstan, and there was the big forum in the Berdakh Theater, and all the intelligence, speaking of the intelligence, there were a lot of intelligence, a lot of progressive people, educated people, and it was the long day for President Karimov. At one point, the negotiations stall And he even went to the airport to go back, and he came back, and nobody talks about that thing. There was the big discussion of the sovereignty of Republic of Pakistan, option A and option B being the one of them really sovereign different republic, and Karimov coming and asking to join that, and Karkopak people didn't want to join. That's why he entered the 20 years of contract. After 20 years, you will do your referendum and you can go separate. That was trick the government used that time.
You know, and then let me on that note mention that Steve just a few minutes ago said that he had started to run into these activists that came from Karakal, Pakistan about 10 years ago, which if we look back is pretty much the eve of when they were supposed to have this referendum on independence and never did. We need to move along a little bit and go to the second half of the show where we're going to discuss what just happened in Gonabadakhshan and in Karakal, Pakistan. First, let me recap real quick. I'm Bruce Panera, the host of the Mejlis podcast, and we're discussing the recent violence in Tajikistan's Gonabadakhshan Autonomous Oblast and in the Karakal, Pakistan Republic in Uzbekistan. Today's guests are Steve Sverdlov, rights lawyer with long experience in Central Asia, who's currently teaching at the University of Southern California, Bakhtiar Safarov, who's originally from Gorno-Badakhshan area, and Murat Kadirov, who is originally from Karakal, Pakistan. And we're moving on now to what just happened. And I will, you know, I want to let Steve get in a little bit and in here and talk about the fallout, what you heard, and then I'll ask Bakhtiar about Gorno-Badakhshan. But Steve, if you could explain what you heard about how the Gorno-Badakhshan problem started, and starting, let's go back to either last November or May, and then we'll get Bakhtiar, and then I'll ask you to comment on Karakal, Pakistan, and we'll ask Murad about that too.
Start with Gorno-Badakhshan or start with Karakal, Pakistan?
Gorno-Badakhshan, please.
Well, in Gorno-Badakhshan, you know, we had a murder that. The local population was demanding an investigation into. We had a number of things that contributed to this, but essentially the central authorities' unwillingness to listen to local demands to investigate, by all accounts, was a crime, and led to further mobilization, protests, or organized protests, peaceful protests, and very reasonable demands coming from Pamiri civil society. There was also the removal of the governor. There were a lot of things that contributed to this, but as of May, another attempt at protest was essentially put down by very violent force. And at this point, Bakhtiar will have the count better than I do, but we're talking about upwards of perhaps north of 50. Is that right, Bakhtiar? People already killed?
Yes. Confirmed like 28, but unconfirmed, they're saying more. So that's the thing we don't know yet because of that. We don't have a third-party independent investigation.
Correct. And as we are sitting here today, I've tried to compile a list of the activists that have been detained, in addition to the disproportionate force, Bruce, that was used on the protesters. And of course, there's still been no independent investigation from the UN or groups like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch. But just to give you a sense of how devastating the wave of arrests of activists and journalists has been, as of this day, we have, for example, two journalists who were part of the Commission 44, which was a legal organization set up to transmit the demands of the population to the government, which was really supposed to be a dialogue between the authorities and the people. So the two journalists who were part of the commission, Ikhtior Saibekov, Muyasar Sadonshoyev, both sentenced to 10 and 11 years. Then two other activists, part of this Commission 44, Hujamri Pirnazarov, Shaftulo Bektavlatov, given 18 years. And then beyond those convictions, as you've discussed on a few previous programs, you have these leading civil society activists like Manuchehr Holeknazarov. He's detained. The lawyer, Farmuz Irgashev, who launched an ill-fated attempt to run for president against Rahmon, also detained. And he's one of the only lawyers that would be available to even represent these people in detention. And then, of course, going back to the very start of this, as the journalist Ulfat Khonim Mamadshoeva, and her arrest was accompanied by a lot of claims from the Tajik authorities that the United States and maybe other Western powers were instigating the unrest. And so really it's been, in addition to that, let me just say the journalist Honora Sarkorova, who a lot of people know, brother, her mother, detained and questioned because of the work she's doing from Prague to illuminate and illustrate the crackdown, and a lot of others that I'm not mentioning here. So it's just been absolutely a devastating crackdown on what is left of civil society in Gorno-Badakhshan.
Okay, you know, and Bakhtiar, could you fill us in too? I mean, since the security operation, which the government later called an anti-terrorist operation, since it started, and now that it's at least the shooting part of it is over, what is Gorno-Badakhshan like today? I mean, what's happening out there?
So basically what's happening, we don't have that much information as we used to have. So every time I call to friends and say, look, they don't want to talk. We have limited information. So I would say the flow of information, the communication has stopped. So, I mean, we get very limited information. And on top of it, we actually now witnessing a lot of, like, we sort of, you know, people that weren't even related. So we see a lot of things that the business now, 11 businessmen were detained. They charging him with a connection to you know, supporting financially the protesters. So we get a lot of reports from the ground like that. So, and the people, and also more and more people for some reason are very desperate and want to leave, which is very, very, you know, it's normal. But since people were living a lot, and you asked me about the social aspects of Gobao, and if you look at the, you know, last census, the population is around 300,000. It used to be the same when the census was done before. So that means that the outflow from the population was even, you know, it was a lot, but now it's probably, we're expecting there's going to be more people that are going to be leaving the area. We do still wait, and we got just today a resolution from European Commission that they're asking for independent investigation. So I think this investigation is very critical at this point, because we actually need a third party who can go and investigate and can come up with a report. So there is certainly the diaspora outside the country are now working on this to make sure that the whole recommendation that's coming from this resolutions implemented. So I think that's pretty much happening. That's what's happening right now.
Okay, thank you, Bakhtiar. Steve, let's go back to you for a second. And can you tell us a little bit about the lead into the violence in Karakol, Pakistan, and what you've been hearing has happened since July 1st, when the security forces actually started opening fire on protesters?
Right. Well, a couple of days prior to July 1st, the government announced that these amendments would be, or we should say deletions or removals of language would appear in the new constitution, the constitution that the government is set to roll out, essentially replacing the old constitution and zeroing out, we should say, President Mirziyoyev's term, allowing him to run again. And this language, as Murad said, would strip Karakol, Pakistan of its autonomy, of its sovereignty. And this immediately touched a nerve among the population. People like Daulat Murad, Taji Muratov, an activist, a lawyer and journalist, and journalists like Lola Gul, Kalihanova, started commenting on this. And by all means, by all accounts, these were peaceful calls for discussion, calls for peaceful meetings. And as of July 1st, we see a mass, I'm talking thousands of people amassing in the streets of Nukus, and then some movement from other cities like Khungrad towards Nukus, and a lot of people calling attention to the fact that this language totally violated the agreement and the rights that the Karakol, Pakistan Republic had. And then the questions begin. Now we're seeing, as of today, the government is really emphasizing that they believe that violent protesters were led by some foreign or external forces, and that protesters started attacking law enforcement personnel. Of course, that's hotly disputed, and we'll need an international investigation to determine exactly what happened. Of course, we don't know that's true by all accounts. So we know from experience that in Central Asia, a lot of law enforcement personnel use disproportionate and excessive force to disperse protesters. And there's still a lot of questions about what weapons, what riot dispersing weapons were used. But as you all saw, we saw emerge on social media countless bloody and gory videos of people with deep cavity wounds, and some videos hotly disputed on both sides. And now, luckily, we've got, you know, one or two foreign correspondents, AFP and Eurasianet, Joanna Lillis, on the ground in Nukus, but we're still awaiting more information about how the protesters were actually dispersed, how the use of force was used on July 1st, July 2nd. And right now, there's a sort of uneasy calm. And certainly, we're starting to see a lot of sort of the rollout of a propaganda campaign by the government to emphasize that this was all coordinated from abroad and that these were violent protesters. And interestingly, Kun Uz, which has a reputation for being the most independent of Uzbek media outlets today, they put out a report. But that report notably begins with the eyewitness testimony of police officers in Nukus who say that the protesters were violent, that they attacked them, surrounded them, had weapons, that they were coordinated. And so, you know, again, it's all a little bit hazy, and we're waiting for more clarity on all of this.
Okay, thank you. You know, and Murad, over to you. I know that you haven't been there in a while, but I also know that it's difficult to get information out of there, and it's probably hard for you to keep in contact with anybody you know, but certainly no one is following what's happened there more closely than you are. Can you give us an idea of what people were saying the last time you were able to get in touch with them, and also what you see on and read and what you think is significant about the reporting that's going on about Karakol Pakistan now?
What's significant about the reporting in Karabakhstan? Its absence, actually. There is no much. I was very pleased to hear from Steve that at least two journalists are in there. What we are hearing from our people, it's actually, first of all, there cannot be any talks about violent gun protests in there because their guns are non-existent in the hands of the people there. Even shotguns are for decades collected from the people, imposing very harsh laws to keep them. I know my friends all voluntarily surrendered their guns rather than dealing with these laws. So there is no gun in the violence. There actually, if you look and see the events just before that, leader Dolatmurat Tajimuratov was calling for the very disciplined, lawful protest. Interesting fact there is actually Dolatmurat Tajimuratov was able pull permission to make like peaceful demonstration in July 5th, which is unthinkable in the given situation, which shows, I think, that Karakol Pak government actually sympathetic to these people. They can just cannot do anything. And besides that, what we have from the information, June 28th, actually, all the guns from the law enforcement within Karakol Pakistan was collected and locked up. And when this protest started, actually, all law enforcement of Karakol Pak people are collected in one place and kept there. So thank you, Steve, for voicing the concerns about the activists like Dolatmurat Tajimuratov and Lalagul Kalakhanov, and we don't really have information about that. What we hear is Dolatmurat Tajimuratov was in critical condition in the ICU, and now we hear that something happened with his mind, and some possibly he was affected by the psychotropic substance or the treatment, and he doesn't sound like in his mind now, and we don't have any information about whereabouts Lalagul Kalakhanova.
You brought up an interesting point. I want to make sure this is clear for our audience too. You said that Taji Muratov had actually gone to the city, to the administration, and said he wanted to hold a protest. So he was looking to hold a legal protest, correct?
He was able to pull that permission to do the peaceful the protest demonstrations at the front of the government building, and they give that permission, and right away he's been arrested from home. But people hearing that he was arrested, they started protesting against that, and he's been released by Karkalpak law enforcement. And after a few hours, actually, special forces from Uzbekistan came and beaten up all whole family, killed few people who was protecting him around his house, and taken him. And by the information we have, he was taking it first to the Khwarezm region, and he kept. We heard when he came out, there is the videos. He's saying, "I need to have a couple hours rest, and I will come back." They if you translate what he said, in terms of they teared me up, and they were hitting me on my heart area. And when he went home that night, around after 3 a.m., he's been taken by Uzbek special forces.
Bakhtiar, I still want to stay with this because to show that they were at least trying to be legitimate protests here, the protesters in May in Horog, before the protest, they also went to the authorities and asked them for permission to hold a protest, or at least told them they were going to hold one. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. They did ask for permission, so they didn't let them. If you remember, on May 14th, they actually gathered in Bar Horog, where the late Mahmud Bokir, Mahmud Bokirov's house, for discussions and getting the permits. They didn't let them, and they just gave them 2 days, and then on May 16th, they were trying to go peacefully to the central Ismaili Somoni Square, but they were stopped, and one people got shot, and that everything. And after that, they asked for more troops, and more troops came in from capital city, and about the Rushon massacre, what happened. Because people didn't want this military convoy to go to Horog, and that's what they did. They actually killed a lot of protesters, and we don't know exactly how many people killed there, and a lot of atrocities. We call it Rushon massacre, what happened after that. And then after couple more weeks, they killed Mahmud Bokir, and they detained other leaders, and it's been going on since then. And if you think about it, there was no reason actually to have this crackdown, because government has its officials over there. They control all the routes, they control all borders, they all control all real economy, the whole mineral reserves that they have. They have a couple of marble and other type of businesses their family is doing. There was no reason actually to be so harsh on the people. But they removed the governor. And then if you remember before that, there were a lot of talks about this Chinese military bases that now we don't hear anything about this, because nobody talks about them anymore. So I think there was a pre-plan to suppress this civil society, so nobody talks about this security program that they have. And they keep asking for security assistance. All countries, they have security cooperation with China, they have security cooperation with Russia, United States, and Europe. But they don't want to deal with the cause of the security. They create the whole chaos, and they want to ask for security. I mean, I think from my point of view, U.S. and Europe and other countries are just wasting their money on the security programs that they had. So, and it just, there was no reason, like even in, compared to Karakal, Pakistan, and whole region is just was recovering from COVID, and now Ukraine and Russia war situation, and everybody knows about the economic consequences, and especially now with Taliban rising in Afghanistan, there was no reason to actually start this special operation. But again, you know, we see that other bigger events inspired those people to act the way they act now.
You know, I want to stick with you for just a second here, and we got to wrap this up real quick. But I want, this calls for your opinion. How much damage has been done between the region's relationship with the government? You know, is this like a watershed moment, and we're never? Do you see any way that they can reconcile after all this has happened?
No, that's in Gabala situation. There's a watershed. There is no way that people are gonna go back unless those people who committed those crimes, the law enforcement who will be brought to justice, and all political prisoners will be released, and the whole, you know, compensations that will be paid for the families, which I don't think they're gonna do. But I don't see the government showing the goodwill and following all those you know, people's demands. And now we have European Commission resolutions, so we'll see. I don't believe they're going to follow until all these resolutions and all people's demand are met. There is no turning back on this situation. It's going to get actually worse, I think.
Murad, same question, and I'll get to you in just a second, Steve. Murad, same question to you. After what just happened, do you see any reconciliation possible between the Karakal Pakistan Republic and the Uzbek authorities? I mean, have we reached a point where things can never be the same between the two?
In generally, the Karakal Pak people and Uzbek people is never ethnically never conflict, at least in latest history. So I want to warn to not to make this ethnic violence. And if Uzbek government recognizes the sovereignty in not only on paper and will start according to constitution, start relationship between two republics on contractual base, on negotiation base, and Karakal Pak people start will be able to elect real representative of their people, I think it could move forward, provided all the human rights violations are investigated and giving right conclusion about it.
And Steve, certainly to your comment, but I also wondered if possible, could you comment on what the governments need to do to try to reconcile the situation there, and also what outside forces, international organizations or individual countries might be able to do to try to help heal the wounds, but also try to prevent this something like this from happening again?
Yeah, no, I mean, these are moments that define these regimes. And just comparing and contrasting Mirzoyev and Rahmon here, I found it interesting that Rahmon was a little bit more open, you could say. He came out in a speech and said, yes, I gave the order. I ordered them to shoot to kill. I had to do it. And in a way, it was unapologetic about the use of force, which, you know, is problematic, but at least it was honest. And I think, you know, Bakhtiar rightly mentions that without more international pressure, there's been a very, very muted to almost non-existent response coming from partners like the United States. Without pressure there, and it's good to see the European Parliament come in with this resolution just yesterday, I don't think we're going to see much of an improvement, and I don't think this problem is going to go away for Tajikistan. It's, you know, interestingly that 30 years ago, you know, who thought, right? We were all saying, who thought that the Soviet Union would be brought down by conflicts like Nagorno-Karabakh, and who predicted that Abkhazia and South Ossetia and Transnistria would become such existential questions? And it's sort of the same here in a way. If you look at this process as an unfolding collapse of the Soviet space, these autonomous provinces both provoke existential crises. In the case of Uzbekistan, President Mirziyoyev has in a way, been more nuanced. He said in remarks on July 6th, I believe it was, that excessive force was used in some cases, and that if it was found to have been used by law enforcement personnel, then those people should be punished. Of course, that's good. But on the other hand, he's emphasized already this narrative of foreign provocateurs without mentioning who that foreign government is. Is it Kazakhstan? Is it Moscow? And I think, as I've said, that really muddies the water, and it worries me because it, again, it harkens back to the way Karimov handled the Andijan massacre. And so I think as to your core question about what should be done now, I think recognizing that issues of ethnic minorities, of autonomy, of decentralization versus the capital are obviously salient. And you know, Kazakhstan also in January this year showed us that as well, that, you know, it was Western Kazakhstan, the most far-flung region that provoked this crisis. I think what that shows us is that, A, Central Asia is in need of a lot of attention from international partners. B, that we need human rights organizations more than ever allowed to do their job, including journalists. And the only way we get that, I think, is if the European Union and the United States government and other partners that have money to spend are willing to make those conditions for their engagement. I think without that, we're going to continue to see socioeconomic issues bubbling to the surface and causing responses from the law enforcement and the state, which involve disproportionate and excessive uses of force, which involves a loss of life. And I, of course, I agree with Murat that there's no long history of ethnic strife between ethnic Uzbeks and ethnic Karakalpaks, but it is worrying, it is troubling that in the heat of the moment, you know, we see a lot of bloggers, pro-government bloggers in Uzbekistan, sort of raising very chauvinistic and nationalistic points. I think I think we need to ignore those voices, and we need to have some sober discussions and really open conversations and open dialogue. I'd like to see the parliament in Uzbekistan hold hearings. I'd like to see TV shows. I'd like to see the same thing in Tajikistan, but there the situation is so abysmal with human rights that it's going to require, I think, more of an external response, a stronger one. So both require international attention. And I think what you're doing, Bruce, by monitoring the situation is extremely important.
Thank you. You know, and I know we really should be out of time, but I'm going to give everyone like 2 minutes to make a last comment if they want to, because this is a really important topic, and it's a really deep topic. And clearly, I can't ask all the questions that probably should be asked on a program like this. So, Murat, I'm going to start out with you. Is there something important that we've missed in this conversation that you think needs to be said about what happened in Karakalpakstan?
I agree with Steve about not let this make it. Actually, these sentiments about the ethnic standing off to these things plays to the president's new election, new changes to constitution in hand, actually. And the outside influence to the events doesn't hold water, I think. It's like the president tried to change these articles, and how that possible outside forces hypnotized him and make them change these articles. I don't understand that outside influence. Yes, there were Karakalpaks and international NGOs from Kazakhstan, from Russia, supporting Karakalpak people, but I don't think there was the state influence from the outside. Thank you.
Steve, what important needs to be said that hasn't been said so far in this show?
Well, first of all, you know, when killing of this scale occurs, I want to express my condolences. I don't know the names of the 18 victims killed in Karakalpakstan, and I don't know all the names of the victims in Gorno-Badakhshan, but I think we need to remember those people. We need to mourn them. We need to write their histories and their stories and tell their stories. Number two, I'm thinking about the fate of those detained in both of these provinces is really, really important to keep in mind and keep at the top of the agenda. That in cases where governments want to showcase that their behavior didn't violate human rights, they like to have show trials. They like to have false testimony. They like to force people to say something that didn't actually occur. And so I think the risk of torture has to be at the top of the agenda. And then finally, I guess I'd say that recommendations for going forward, I think Tajikistan is far past the point where there should be a soft engagement or soft power. I think there we've seen such a wide spectrum of violence and of human rights violations that we've long needed to have a more robust response, including sanctions directed at the government for what has happened. And it does, you know, really acquire some existential characteristics for the people of the Pamirs, an ethnic minority that has really been targeted in a way that we just don't often think about. So I think there has to be a very tough response on Tajikistan. When it comes to Uzbekistan, the door in a way is still open. The jury is still out. The government at least is saying that they're going to allow international observers. But we have seen that several have had trouble getting in. And so it's really important days get in Uzbekistan. So I hope that we can return to this topic and again, make sure the due process is followed for all of these trials and investigations that are about to take place.
Okay, thank you very much. And Bakhtiar, I guess that I'll give you the last word on this one too. What haven't we said during this show, during the program, that's important that you think it needs to be said? Here's your opportunity.
This is the very important thing to mention is this all turmoil that's happening right now in both Karakal, Pakistan, and Kazakhstan and the Central Asia region. That's the thing that all experts, people who know the region, have been telling this government to do. So, but instead of, you know, listening to these experts, you know, local and international experts, everything was ignored. All those experts were, you know, local experts jailed or disappeared. International experts, you know, like people like you have been, you know, always vocal about this. But it's not happening. You know, we don't see any. It's actually getting worse rather than getting better. I think now it's a time to you know, the people who, especially international experts, have to make sure that all the resolutions then policy documents that coming from the European government and U.S. and other Western countries, so that will be implemented. So we have to have a sort of action plan for those documents that come and implement those, you know, recommendation, especially with investigating both in Karakal, Pakistan, and in Gabao, so we would know what really happened, and based on this, have the all strategic documents that you know was developed recently in Central Asia and in United States.
Thank you very much, Bakhtiar, and thank you to all our guests on this program. I could go on with this for hours and hours, but we do have to wrap this up. It is supposed to be a podcast that people can listen to very quickly while they're doing whatever they're doing. So thanks to my guests. We have Murad, who's originally from Karakal, Pakistan. We have Bakhtiar Safarov, who's originally from Gorno-Badakhshan. And, of course, Steve Sverdlov, who's well-known to anyone who follows Central Asia, veteran of the area, and someone, one of the leading rights defenders for all the peoples of Central Asia. Thank you very much for being on the program. And a big thank you also to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C., and a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting RFARL's website at rfarl.org. I'm Bruce Panier. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.